Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it.
All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold cut combo, veggie delight, or Black Forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rusland, this week we have BFM's very own Lee Trelin.
Hello, hello.
We have returning quite recently, actually.
Yay.
He's a father, he's a journalist, he's a podcaster.
Oh, yeah.
Zahn Azli.
Hello.
Hello, hello. And our three topics this week is, topic number one is Olympic memes. Topic number two is Olympic commentary sexism. And topic number three is Manglish. Is it okay or not? So at the time of recording, the Olympics are on. They'll be on for a short while more. And, well, I've been watching it. Lynn, have you?
I've been watching it, yeah. I've not just been watching it, actually. I think I've been, like most people now, devouring it in ways other than just watching it. Because I think that's the thing about the Olympics now. It's become an experience that's not just about what happens on the track or in the pool. Or, you know, it's also about the reporting around it and the memes. I mean, what did we do without the memes? What did you guys do back in 96 or, you know, whatever?
Yeah, the memes. Yeah, imagine people didn't understand what you meant by that. I mean, obviously I do.
I know you do. I saw the gleam of understanding enter your face. Well, a meme, I feel so condescending now. Memes, I think everyone's seen them. They're just sort of popular images that get captured. You know, they're sort of these little moments of amber in our pop culture moment, and they get translated to all sorts of other unusual circumstances. I think the sort of big one that came out of London was Michaela's Not Impressed. Michaela Maroney, silver or bronze medalist, I forget now, from the Olympics women's US gymnast team, pulling the most epic unimpressed face on the podium.
All right.
And that went all the way up to Obama. She's got a picture of herself doing that next to Obama, who's also doing it, which is great. And this Olympics, I think the one that's kind of really made its way, well, into a tattoo was Michael Phelps's mean face, which he did to South African swimmer, whose name I forget now, because you know what? Doesn't matter. Michael Phelps.
So, are we talking just individual images or the stories behind the greatest stories?
Often you end up with the images, right? The images outlive the stories, and that's the thing about the Olympics. And I think with the Olympics, the stories outlive the races, and then the memes outlive the stories. And that's a strange thing. I think we're operating now in a world where, you know, we won't remember what time Usain Bolt won that semi-final with or who he beat. We'll remember that image of him grinning as he passes the finish line.
Zahn, have you been watching the Olympics?
Well, this is one Olympics that I sad to say that I haven't been really following, because I follow the Olympics, I follow all these big sporting events, but I recently cancelled my Astro subscription, so I thought I wasn't going to get any Olympic channels.
Wow.
Then I found out, hey, Unified Olympic channels do as well.
And RTM.
Yeah.
But actually, yeah, in the lead up to this particular Olympics, I had no interest whatsoever. And I think it would have been like Zahn. And then suddenly it was there. And then, of course, I was absorbed. I was pulled in again.
But that's the magic of the Olympics, right? No, because I was not somebody who was dying for the Olympics to start. I think we're all on the same page here. And I entered it through memes. I did, actually, you know, because these things started coming up and I was like, why are we talking about Lily King wagging her finger? Why are we talking about Michael Phelps' face? And suddenly I just had to know, you know, and that is how I got myself dragged into Olympic drama.
I don't think this is a new thing, though. I think that single images have been used, conjured up throughout the history of these great events, that we walk away at the end of it with just remembering one image.
These aren't great images, though. I mean, these are images that that can be funny. They don't have to be epic. I mean, the Usain Bolt one manages to be both, and I think that's why it's kind of become its own thing. But if you look at the Michael Phelps one, that, like I said, has become a tattoo, it's not a great iconic sporting image. It doesn't exactly make you feel inspired to run out there and start swimming butterfly or anything. It just makes you want to defeat an opponent and smash his face into a swimming wall.
Okay. Look, Zan, you and I, we're the old timers here. Lynn, she's a young thing.
Meme generation.
Who can't remember the 1996 Olympics.
Where is it? In Atlanta, Southern Carolina or whatever. Atlanta. Yes, it was Atlanta.
I can remember images and stories from way back. And I guess they weren't necessarily as jokey, personal, as informal. They were more heroic, perhaps. Mm.
But were they ever removed from the story that they originated from? That's the difference between a meme and an iconic image. Anything can be an iconic image. A meme, however, is something that is then removed. You know, Ellen DeGeneres...
Is repeatable... And it's repeatable. In other circumstances.
Yes, exactly. For example, Ellen DeGeneres photoshopped herself onto Usain Bolt's back to accusations of racism, but that's another story, and said, from now on, this is how I'm going to do my shopping. Right. You know, and you could do that all the time. Like, off the top of my head, you could photoshop a baby koala onto the back of Usain Bolt and, you know, say something like, Mama Bear. I don't know. It's just, these are the things that you can generate.
These are the things that anyone can generate. Well, anyone apart from me.
In any circumstance. But the iconic images that you're speaking of, you know, of like the Black Power salute, for example, on the podium, that's not a meme. That's an icon.
Okay, so that's something that I could have no control over. Nowadays, I could play with.
You could, but, you know, it's... See, these are the meme subtleties, Cam, that you might never get, young one.
I'm trying to learn. I want to get the gold on this. You honestly think that we've passed into a new phase then? This is different.
It's not new. I mean, since 1996 Texas Olympics, okay, I jest. It's Atlanta, I know. But, you know, since the 2000s, or maybe just since we've entered this phase of the internet, you know, this phase of memeing the internet, I think we are actually at a new phase of enjoying or absorbing sporting events like the Olympics, like the World Cup, like the Euros, like anything big enough to have the internet all a Twitter over it. We have entered a new phase. You guys don't need to watch a single match to know all the big stories of the Olympics. You just don't.
Okay. Well, before we move on then, Zan, you teach journalism.
Yes, I do.
Right?
Yes.
So do you think, very briefly, that do you get a sense that we're into a new phase in terms of the reporting and the telling of stories?
Oh yeah, of course. I'm sure that this is going to be a new way of telling stories. I don't know how factual and accurate it's going to be, right? But I think it does represent that certain time, and it does give people an idea of wanting to find out more. Because I remember my wife showing me a video of the Malaysian diver, the guy who slammed body first into the water, and that, kind of like you, made me want to watch the Olympics. Mm. You know, so you wouldn't know the backstory, you don't know anything, but it becomes like a catalyst for you to enter it.
Okay. It's not always about greatness anymore.
All right. Well, okay. Well, one Olympic extreme to another. I'd like to ask about commentary and sexism. Because, Lynn, as you know, I'm a feminazi.
That in and of itself, Cam, is so problematic.
You know, I'm more hardline than you on these things. But for instance, just recently, the Malaysian mixed doubles pair won the silver medal. Or you could say failed to win the gold medal. I'm not sure. You take your pick. But anyway, I'm about to say the female athlete, but we'll get on to it. Guo Liuying, I noticed that she was in a... had a story about her in the Star newspaper, and the story headline was that she is hot on and off the court. And then the photographs for her were, she's looking very pretty, and she's got the wind machine blowing through her hair, and, you know, not all very tasteful, but it was about her looks. And as I was thinking, that just doesn't seem right. That doesn't seem right. I mean, she's a pretty girl, and she obviously wanted to do it, so, you know, that's fine. And then also another thing that struck me is odd, the commentary done by Australians, who are not necessarily the most, you know, they were talking about, I was watching the women's discus, and they kept referring to, he kept referring to them as the lady discus. Yeah, and he said it so often, it's just like, each time it's like, this just doesn't sound right. And I, you know, Lynn, as I know where I stand on these feminist things, you know me.
I do.
Right. But what do you think?
Well, I was just wondering whether, because I mean, you guys have been talking about how you haven't been super engaged with the Olympics or, you know, not extremely engaged. And there have been so many lists that have come out this particular Olympics about the most sexist things that have happened, simply because, I don't know why, maybe it's because more and more people are becoming aware of the problems of, you know, how we refer to women, how we talk about female athletes. But, I mean, someone was, a medalist was referred to only as someone else's wife, for instance. When she won a race, a swimmer, the commentator did not even commend her for it, but they cut to instead an image of her husband and her coach, same person, you know, kind of fist pumping, and they said, and right, there's the man behind it. That, to me, is more problematic than ladies. I think we need to talk a little bit more about how, yeah, how lady athletes... how athletes, female athletes, women, are disrespected in terms of how they're spoken about. It happens all the time.
Suzanne, I mean, you one, you're a journalist, so you have to name things. you have to find a language. But also, you're a father of two girls now.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, how would you like them to see these stories, and in the future as they get older, how would you like to see them be treated?
You know, when you said that you saw that story in the newspaper about the badminton player, says she's hot on and off the court.
Yeah.
You know, same, just like you, I would feel like, hey, there's something wrong there, you know? Mm. And if my daughters did something like that and they were, you know, they were depicted in that way, I would feel the same way. But then I used to discuss this with my wife, and she would say, hey, what's wrong with that? Why can't you be hot and a good badminton player? Why can't you acknowledge? So I'm like, okay.
Answer that, Lynn.
I'm scared.
Well, that's the thing, right?
That's what, because I was thinking that. I mean, she is pretty, and she wants to be seen as pretty, and, you know, that's okay.
No, but there is acknowledgement, is there not, that she's hot on the court as well, in terms of her skill as a badminton player. I think the issue that happens is when you completely ignore ability in lieu of discussing meaningless drivel. You know, like, oh yay, let's celebrate her coach instead of her. There were medalists, like I said, who were described only as wife of so-and-so, because her husband was also another famous athlete. Wife of so-and-so won a medal. What is that?
That's just
crazy, are you defining women other than how we wish to be defined? I mean, if we are at the Olympics representing our country, clearly you should report on us as athletes representing our country, first and foremost.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, for instance, if we all remember back to Maria Sharapova.
Oh, yes.
She was a tennis player. She was never higher than, I don't know, fourth or fifth or something in the world. But the emphasis that was put on her, she was... The stories about her, there were so many, because she's a very good-looking woman. Did I say that right? I'm not sure. Maybe I shouldn't have said. Anyway, and, you know, meanwhile, other tennis players, the Williams sisters, for instance, I think a lot of journalists have trouble knowing how to report the Williams sisters.
And a lot of it comes down to the body, for example. You know, the body of Serena Williams is constantly criticized because it appears...
Is it criticized or just simply commented
criticized,
on?
Criticized. Actively criticized. Mm. You know, you have people saying things like, oh, I would not want to look like her. You know, there's something not right about looking like her. There's an implication that strength is somehow an undesirable trait, that tennis players should look like Maria Sharapova or should not be world number one or should not be the greatest of all time, you know, which is crazy. But before we get to that, or rather in lieu of that, I do want to say to the both of you, I feel as if there is an implication here that it is a very difficult thing to talk about women. And I don't think it is. I think you talk about women the way you would talk about yourselves. And if you just apply that, you know, would you want to be referred to exclusively as husband of? Would you want to be spoken about only in terms of, ooh, your pants don't fit right? You know, if you just apply that and you go from there, if people just got used to thinking about women as equal to and same as, we wouldn't have to have these convoluted conversations about it.
Well, in that case, then I don't mind being described as being hot in and out of the studio.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm happy to do that for you, Cam, because that's what you want.
I'll wait for that story to come out.
But it's a sound story. It's not a picture story. Okay. Oh, no, it's not that I'm no, I... It's not. This is not my commentary. I mean, these. I'm referring to the commentaries done by other people. Mm. You know, I'm on your side. No, it's just that the language does. It's becoming increasingly difficult to stomach. I mean, back in the 70s, 80s, this language is used all the time, and I never thought anything of it. Mm-hmm. But now it's beginning to sound not
dated.
Very dated.
That's fair. I think that's a fair accusation to kind of hurl at it, you know, that it's a dated way of referring to women, because I think women as a word works just fine.
Yeah.
For example.
Yeah. Okay, all right. And that's coming from a lady.
Yes, exactly. Okay. A proud one.
And so, more on language, in fact, Manglish, in a moment here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9.
Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during Red, White, and Blue Savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience and the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.
And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Lee Chui Lin, and Zan Azli. Zan, you are a journalist.
Yes, I am.
Therefore, you write in language.
I try to, yes.
In clear and cogent sentences.
Uh-huh.
And yet, you would like to speak in praise of Manglish.
Yes, yes, yes. I think that there's a place for colloquial English. English is widely spoken. It's one of the most widely spoken languages in the world. Different regions in the world have different ways of speaking English. Like you have the Queen's English, you have American English, you have Canadian English, Australian English, which has their own colloquial words. On local words and slangs and all that. Yeah, right.
That's right. In the dictionary.
Yeah. And in Malaysia, we have Manglish, but a lot of people who speak English, English-speaking Malaysians, kind of don't like to acknowledge it as a legit language, and they always say, hey, you got to speak proper English, proper grammar and all that. But why can't they embrace the fact that Malaysian English, Manglish, is just a legit form of English? You know, with all the las and the gostan and the, you know, all the colloquial slangs, you know. And I would actually like to see it appear in formal writing.
Really?
What do you guys think?
Wow. Wow.
So the first thing I thought of was that I've recently seen a fair amount of news reports from the Philippines. And what I found most interesting about it was that I found myself understanding about, I would say, 40% of what was being reported, despite the fact that they were conducting it in what I thought was Tagalog, to be honest. I was just listening and thinking, okay. And then I realized it was because in an official news report, you know, and this was across different channels, they were using Taglish. And so I understood a goodish amount, because the English words I'd get and then the other words I'd lose. But the point is, they were swapping in and out of it completely seamlessly. And even when they showed, for example, their president giving a press conference or, you know, just speaking about something, same thing happened. I mean, I'm not sure what languages he was switching in and out of. I think there might have been more than one, but English was among them. And that, to me, was fascinating, because this is, it's the equivalent of BFM going Manglish.
But I don't know if the Philippines historically has had a strong kind of formal relationship with the English language. If you
they
know
have.
I mean.
They're an American colony, right?
Yes, they are.
Yeah, no, but I don't know how deep the roots went.
Right.
See, I wouldn't say we have any deeper roots than they do.
I don't know, but I think we do have deep roots. I don't know. I can't compare and contrast too much with the Philippines, but I think the roots, the expectation here is to speak not just a functioning English language, but a idiomatic English, which I think is a great pressure to put on people. But by idiomatic, I mean literally grandparents will know idioms. Too many cooks spoil the broth. Will know how to sing Irish folk songs. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how deep the rootedness has been.
I feel like that's a personal relationship you have with the language that I don't.
Well, no? That's true, though, because my grandparents are very Anglophile. Yeah,
My grandparents are not. So you see, this is the difference,
but,
right?
Yeah, but there are many grandparents who have been.
Yeah. And I can understand that. But I like this idea of Manglish coming to the fore, because I think English in and of itself is a bastardized language, and I think that we often hold it to too precious a standard.
Look, the Malay literature scene, right, literary scene, we've got all these new pop fiction coming out, right,
yeah,
that is using very street language, Malay, yeah, right, and they've been criticized by Dewan Bahasa and all that for bastardizing the language, yeah, but it's the way that Malay is spoken in the streets by people, so why can't, you know, English be spoken the way it's spoken
okay,
by...
Okay, I'm on your side, brother.
Okay.
I don't know that you are. I think I you're pretending. No,
I very much am in terms of, yes, just a conversational language. But and if it's in novels, etc., I'm okay with that as well. But I think that there is a danger that... See, language is just a code. It's just any old code. It doesn't matter if it's Italian or whatever. It's just a code that we all agree upon and that we all should be able to understand. If we can read the language, we should be able to understand each other, right, when we write it. The danger is when we then start writing in a language that we're supposed to be agreed upon and we don't understand what the other person's saying, or when you write it and you are misunderstood.
Isn't that somewhat the beauty of having Manglish be formalized in some ways? Because I could make an argument, and I will now, that it might help you actually understand your fellow Malaysian a little bit better. Because the thing about Manglish is that it does not come, the syntax does not come from Chinese or from Malay or from anything else.
It's kind of
a soup,
yeah,
you know, and I like that about it.
And I like it too. It comes from your individual background. I'm basing this on the fact that a short while ago, I was editor at a magazine, Esquire. So I received a lot of text written by a lot of different people. And everybody has a somewhat different personal history with the English language. They could be Malay, Chinese, Indian, what have you, in a English-speaking, grown up in English-speaking household, not the school, maybe good, blah, blah, blah. So they all write it the way they hear it in their head. Not everybody hears it, says it exactly the same. I think every Malaysian speaks it slightly differently. And so therefore it leads to a lot of misunderstanding when you're trying to lay down a document that everyone is supposed to understand.
Then it should be formalized.
You're arguing for informalization. So how do you...
formalize? Not really. It's kind of formalizing and informalized... standard,
yes,
you know,
exactly
what I'm saying?
So because you have a committee to sit round and agree,
yeah,
this
okay
is how we... Well, then you're back to square one and it's the same again.
No, but at least it's regional and it's local.
Yeah, but no, but it's now been owned by this committee.
All language is like that. You're never going to have...
No, it's not. French is like that, but English is not like that.
If I can offer a story, this has happened twice today with the same person, where a friend kind of did not grasp one of your precious idioms, Cam. Mm. And it was one of those moments in which you realize that, fine, maybe the grandparents understand this, maybe some of us understand this, but this person does not. And this is a widely accepted idiom, right? And so in that instance, you look at that and you understand that language will never have any perfect understanding. And there's nothing wrong with... No one is suggesting that Manglish replaced the Queen's. But I think that it would make English feel a lot closer to home for people who don't feel it is close to home.
And that's fine if we're speaking it to each other. But what happens when you write it down in a document that, and that's supposed to represent who you are to the world? And then people will judge you on that document. And it's filled with wrong things. Well, not wrong things, but just it's just you're not understood. Doesn't that make you then look bad?
No, it shows the context. It shows the context, it shows the background, it shows culture, it shows...
Yeah, but it doesn't show meaning. It doesn't show the precise meaning that you
context
want to put over.
Context is meaning.
No, it's not.
Look.
In some settings,
no,
it
what
is.
I mean is, like, for instance, you know, don't go out there now because it's on fire. Right? I think that's kind of clear. But if you say that in a way that's unclear and the meaning comes over as go out there now because it's great, but that's not what you meant.
But I don't think that will happen. Look, if you compare British dictionary and an American dictionary, it's different. You compare an Australian dictionary with an American dictionary, it's different. So why can't you have a Malaysian English dictionary and you compare it and it's also different? It's you standardize it enough so that people won't misunderstand each other, right? But yet still just local and regional enough to have an identity.
And to grow.
Yeah.
And to grow, because languages need that, I think. Otherwise,
yeah, but,
they die.
Yeah, but you're arguing, though, that it gets nailed down. It becomes formalized. So what is it? Do you want it formalized or informal?
you formalize the informal.
That, but then,
and it will continue. It will continue to change.
Yeah, just leave it alone.
It will continue.
Look, I'm on your side, brother.
Oh boy.
All I'm concerned is that I've received so many documents written by people who I know are perfectly intelligent and who have great minds, but when I read what they've written, it comes over as gibberish. And I am worried that people misrepresent themselves, because language to me is just a code. And if you're then not really bothering to work the code, you come over badly. Now, conversational is different from written.
Look, I read Roddy Dahl's novel, Paddy Clark. Mm-hmm. It's written Irish slang from a five-year-old perspective. I totally did not understand it, but I had to, you know, refer, do some research to understand the background. And slowly, I understood the story, and I understood why, you know, the things that happened, the way it happened in the story, why the child was saying what he was saying. So it helped me understand the culture even better.
That's fine if it's a novel, but if it's a business letter, then it's a problem. That's all I'm saying. I mean, in novels and literature, fine. But I'm just really worried about efficiency and understanding in formal situations.
Which has already made its way here to some degree, no? I mean, with words like broker, not broker. What's the word that we use for broker that's very specific to us? You can take this out, Daryl. But there is something. There is something that we use in a business setting that is a Malaysianism. It's been pointed out. Mm. No one else uses it. It's something like broker, but not. A remiser.
Remiser.
Is that not around
that's
the
not,
world?
But you don't even know that. You see what I mean? This is my point. You don't even know that. But it is not widely used. Try doing that in America. See how far you get. You know? So it's fine. It's fine. And that would be found in a business letter.
That's okay. But, all right, fine. All right. Whatever. Whatever. Yeah, I don't think you're getting my point. I'm not being understood, and that's my fault. So anyway, we move on to the final part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something we think might be of interest. And I do believe that Lynn's going to go first.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to recommend a single episode of This American Life that I heard a little while ago, recently kind of resurfaced and made me think all over again. And I found it very haunting, very beautiful. It is episode 589, if I'm getting that right. If I'm not, just look for Tell Me I'm Fat, I think is what it's called. And it is a collection of stories, all by women, sort of about being fat, about not wanting to be fat, about the things you will do to try and understand why you're fat and not happy, or why now you're thin but you're still not happy. And it's glorious. It's wonderful. It's one of the most open and really touching things that I've heard about, you know, about a group of people that I think many people still don't fully understand. If you've never been fat, you don't understand. And it's great. It was wonderful. It's either Tell Me I'm Fat or it's episode 589. Either way, it's fairly recent. It's, I think, in the month of July.
This American Life has been, I think, recommended on this show more than anything else.
But a single episode.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a win. But Ira Glass, that he's really losing his voice. He has a vocal problem.
Oh no.
It's rather sad. Anyway, okay, This American Life, I think, recommendation number 10, at least. My recommendation is, I read books, and often I'm reading books which I feel are of no interest to anybody else, but I have to say it anyway. I'm going through, and Lynn and I were comparing notes earlier, an American history thing right now, and the U.S. Civil War specifically. And there's one writer who I'm really enjoying. He actually is the guy who wrote Forrest Gump. Right. And he's written two books, which I think are just terrific, about two different campaigns. One is called Vicksburg 1863, and the other one is Shiloh 1862. And his name is Winston Groom. And the research, the way it's written, the stories he tell, it's got that... He's not academic, so it has that sort of This American Life kind of
storytelling feel,
which an academic would probably frown upon. But it's just really compelling, and he's a wonderful writer. He is from the South himself, so he's sympathetic, but at the same time, he is not sympathetic to the political wants of the Southerners. But I don't know. U.S. Civil War for me is like, it's fascinating. I can't get enough of it right now. Winston Groom. So, Zan, what you got?
What I want to recommend today is something that's slightly related to the topic that I brought to the studio. I've been watching a lot of films online, so I would like to recommend people to check out the proliferation of these online short film platforms. Websites like FilmDo, websites like Vidsy, FIFO TV, you know, Tapao TV. These are like, you know, platforms that show short films that are very local, that are very contextual, that are very very regional, and it opens your eyes to cultures and subcultures that you've never really noticed before. So go out there and look for these kind of films.
Mm, yeah. That sounds great. Mm-hmm. Did you know about that, Lynn?
No.
I didn't.
Well, not all of them, but
no,
yeah.
No, I don't know any of them. Producer Daryl, I'm supposed to be kept up to date with these things. Okay, can you name them again one more time?
There's FIFO TV. That's a YouTube channel. F-E-E-F-O.
F-E-E-F-O.
Dot
okay.
TV. Hey Orang Kita came out on that channel, if you know that telemovie. There's a Vidsy, which is very Southeast Asian based. There's FilmDo, FilmDo.com, which has films from regions all over the world. Mm-hmm. There's Tapao TV, which is very local, mm-hmm. Malaysian local, right? And a lot more. You just need to search. There's even these independent filmmakers like James Lee, who has Doghouse 73 Pictures on YouTube and all that. Very interesting films that you don't normally get to see.
Are these sites curated or just people just put up their movies?
Most of it curated.
Right.
Yeah, some are paid, some are free.
Wow, yeah. That sounds great. I'll check them out. I have to write them down before you leave. Okay, so there you go. That's go check out the websites, which I think we're going to try and put on our website. And yes, so only remains me now to thank our special honor guest, Zan Asli.
Thank you very much.
Lee Twillin.
Thank you.
And both myself, Cram Raslan. If you'd like to get in touch with us, please do so on our, well, we got like Instagram. We got
Snapchat,
not me. Twitter. Zan, are you on all of these things?
I'm on all the social media platforms, at Fat Bidin.
Right, because it's not your name, is it?
No,
it's always Fat Bidin. Okay. and also check out Zan's podcasts films. Can I call them films? Not films.
Videos, films, whatever.
Video blogs of his journeys around the world.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yes, join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on 22.3. Oh, only kidding. 89.9. I knew all along.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it.
All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold cut combo, veggie delight, or black forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.